Genesis 4, 1 through 7 is an introductory text to our lesson. And the lesson is titled, God Demands Self-Control. God Demands Self-Control. I was Googling this morning. Now, you know what? 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I never would have said that, because I wouldn't have no idea what I'd be saying. Googling. Where did we come up with these words? Well, I Googled this morning the difference between self-control and self-discipline. And I found a wacky assortment of answers. But the basic thing is, those two are so close that they're almost twins. Self-discipline is where you restrain yourself and train yourself to accomplish some goal that you have to accomplish, to make some change. Self-control is basically where you rein in your impulses and you try to control your emotional outbursts, control reactions. That's the difference, and it's a very subtle difference. They're almost twin brothers of one another. This morning, as we talk about self-control, who better than to help us understand it than old Cain? I mean, he is the epitome of self-control, isn't he? Said no one ever. Because this man is certainly not an example of self-control. Here's a man that gives way to his passions, to his feelings, to his impulses, to his desires, and kills his own brother. Proverbs 25 verse 28 says, whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. New King James Version. I want you to notice that what God says to Cain in verse 7, as we read a moment ago. God says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you. But you should rule over it. You should rule over it. God demands self-control. During the early days of aviation, a stunt pilot at a county fair was giving rides to people. And he was charging $50 a ride. That's a pretty expensive ride back in the day. But he was charging $50 a person. Well, this old farmer, he had seen airplanes and he wanted to fly in one. He and his wife both wanted to fly in one, but he said, I can't pay you $100. He said, but I'll tell you what, I really want my wife and me to be able to fly in this plane with you. Won't you do it for less? Can't you do something? And they got into this argument, you know, and finally the pilot says, look, I'll tell you what, I'll take you both up on one condition. I'll take you both up for $50, but on one condition, and that is you can't make a sound. Not one sound while we're flying. I don't want to hear a word. I don't want to hear a scream. I don't want to hear nothing. And they both agreed. So it's just a two-seater, so the farmer gets in the back. Pilot's in the front. Farmer gets in the back, and he's got his wife. She sits in his lap. They strap in, and they're gone. They're, you know, ready to go. All right? So they get up, and they fly. And the pilot, he says, I'm going to scare this old boy. So he starts doing loop-de-loops and barrel rolls and all kinds of power dives. And you just name it. He was trying every trick in the book, and the farmer never made a sound. So as they were taxiing onto the runway, they came in for a landing. And the pilot doesn't look back, of course. He's just taxiing on the runway, and he's coming in for a landing. He says, well, I tell you what, I'm amazed. You really exhibited a lot of self-control. I said, I tried everything that I could to get you to say something, and nothing was said. And the farmer said, yeah, it was an amazing ride. He says, but I almost said something when my wife fell out. Self-control. Let's continue reading this text. In Genesis 4, verses 8 through 11. Now Cain talked with Abel, his brother. He talked with him. I don't know what they talked about. But he talked with him. And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Tell you what, Cain was a character, wasn't he? And he said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." How many of you would agree that many, if not most, of the problems that we face in this life and the problems of society today stem from a lack of self-control? Just an absolute lack of self-control. The evidence of a lack of self-control is seen in excessive spending, greed, materialism, outbursts of anger and road rage and rudeness, drug abuse, binge eating, theft, illicit sex, divorce, murder, and on and on and on we could go. Now, this describes a society today that lives with a desire for immediate gratification. It is said that you can offer a child an ice cream cone right now, or a gallon of ice cream and a box of ice cream cones tomorrow, and every child, every small child, without exception, will choose the ice cream cone right now. That's part of being a child. Immediate gratification. This is what we want. When a baby gets hungry, a baby cries. It wants to be fed. When a baby is wet, it cries because it wants to be changed right now. And it doesn't matter if, you know, mom is elbow deep with dishes. It doesn't matter if there's some emergency going on. That baby wants immediate gratification. That's part of being a child. A society that wants immediate gratification is exhibiting characteristics of a little child. Childishness. Now somebody says, we can't control ourselves. Is that it? Or is it that we will not control ourselves? That's the question I have. Now, not surprisingly, this lack of self-control goes way back to the beginning of the human race. It goes all the way back to Cain. Well, actually, before that, Adam and Eve didn't show much self-control in the garden, did they? When God says, there's one thing you do not do. Do not touch this tree. Do not eat its fruit. Leave it alone. Self-control, self-discipline. Okay, it's pretty, yeah. This tree would make us wise, yeah. And it's probably good for eating, but we're not going to bother it because God said leave it alone. But they didn't show much self-control, did they? They went with their impulses and they ate of the tree. And then, of course, their son Cain lacked self-control even to a greater extent than his parents in killing his own brother. Why do we lack self-control? Why is this the case? Well, I would suggest a few reasons. Number one, it starts with many with a selfish attitude. That's where it starts with many people, a selfish attitude. Notice that Cain brought a mediocre sacrifice to God. Abel brought the first fruits, the firstling of his flock, the best of his flock, the most expensive, the best looking, the best health-wise. This was the best of his flock. He brought the best. It just simply says Abel brought of his fruit. Of the vegetables and fruit that he brought of it. He just brought some and offered a substandard sacrifice to God. Now, I don't know how Abel knew that his sacrifice was accepted and Cain knew that his was rejected. I saw on a movie a depiction of this one time that stuck in my mind when I was a little boy. I saw where Abel offered his sacrifice and the smoke went up and it was beautiful. And then Cain offered his sacrifice, and the smoke just kind of hovered around him, and he's coughing and choking and everything, and the smoke won't even go up. Well, that's a pretty good depiction from an image, but I don't know how God let it be known. I don't accept this. I don't respect this sacrifice. But nonetheless, Cain knew that his sacrifice was not respected, not accepted, and it wasn't because he brought fruit. It was because he did not bring his best. And this was a problem of selfishness. He wanted to keep the best for himself. Abel brought the firstborn because he wanted to give the finest he could offer to God. Hebrews 11:4, by faith Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it he being dead still speaks. Because of what Cain did, what Abel did, his reputation is very good, isn't it? Because of what Abel did, he had a great reputation that still speaks to this day. Because of what Cain did, he has a very bad reputation that still speaks to this day. The whole issue here then has to do with the attitude one has in the sacrifices or worship that they offer to God. When God didn't approve Cain's offering, Cain gets angry. And God says, basically, Cain, you need an attitude adjustment. You need to change your attitude. God warned Cain, sin is waiting at the door. It's crouching at the door, waiting for you. But you should rule over it. You should rule over it. These impulses, these feelings, this attitude, you need to rule over it. Maybe that's what Peter is thinking when he writes in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. The New Century Version says, control yourself and be careful. The NIV says, be self-controlled and alert. King James says, be sober, be vigilant. It's all the same. We might want to do a little self-examination in this area, folks. Are we guilty of having an arrogant, selfish attitude? In our giving to God, in our church attendance, in our spiritual walk, are we giving God our best or are we giving Him the leftovers? Just asking. Just asking. In our worship to God, are we seeking to be entertained with some meaningful experience or are we seeking to please our God? See, this is the difference between true worship and self-worship or selfish worship. Too many churches today are guilty of selfish worship. Why do you think they're bringing in instrumental music? Somebody says, oh, no, I don't know about this. Why do you think they're bringing it in? Because they like it. Because they think that's going to boost church attendance. Because they think that it is something that's going to make them fit in with society. It's all about them and it's not about God. Now, if it's about God, let's get some Scripture in this and let's see if we can't come to an understanding. But if it's all about me, then Scripture doesn't matter. In our worship, are we seeking our own meaningful experience? When I worship God and I worship God well, when I pour out my heart to God in worship, I do receive a great blessing. It is a meaningful experience for me. There's nothing wrong with having a meaningful experience. There's nothing wrong with some laughter and some humor in a sermon. There's nothing wrong with some tears and some grief in a sermon. There's absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying the good singing or really getting something out of a brother's prayer. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not why we do it. Amen? That's not why we do it. Why we do it is to make God happy. To please God. That's why we worship. Why are you here this morning? Are you here for what you can get? Hey, God bless you if you get something out of it. That's great. We call that a serendipity. It's an unexpected benefit. Great. You got a benefit. I'm happy for you. Was God pleased by you being here? Has God been glorified? Have you offered worship to God that's acceptable to Him? If you've done this, then your reason for being here, just right. But if the reason you're here is just for yourself, you got the wrong attitude. You got the same attitude as Cain. Same exact attitude. Selfish, self-centered attitude. It's got to be about God and not about me. Are you listening, 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 listening? It's got to be about God and not about me. That, my friends, is the right attitude. Cain was guilty. He was guilty. So, what does all this have to do with self-control? This message about Cain? When self-control is not present, we place ourselves before God in order of importance. It's all about me. When we begin to enthrone ourselves instead of bowing before God's throne, we lose our perspective. And sin is crouching at the door. And it begins to invade our hearts. So number one, one reason we lack self-control is because of a selfish attitude. Two, we often give in to our impulses and desires. Cain felt resentment for Abel. He talked with him. He's feeling resentment. Abel, you think you're better than me. Abel, you're some, you know, goody two-shoes. Yeah, God liked you. He didn't like me. I'm not going to stand for this. Abel had an impulse to kill his brother, and that's exactly what he did. He talked to him, and then he killed him. We need to recognize that God is in charge. And it's not about me. And I need to not give in to these sinful impulses. And you know, here's what happens. Here's what happens. When David sinned with Bathsheba, he was acting on an impulse of lust. When Peter denied Jesus before the people, when he was on trial, he acted on an impulse of fear. And like them, when we lose self-control, it usually is because we're acting on an impulse. We are having a moment of lust or greed or anger or something else that for that moment has us in its grasp. So we give in to our impulses. Number three, we become rebellious. You would think that when Cain saw his dead brother lying there, he would have been heartbroken. I mean, they grew up together. They're both adults. They're not little boys. They're not little boys. You know, some people try to picture them as teenagers. They're grown men. They grew up together. They were close. And yet Cain did not have a penitent heart. He was not heartbroken. He was, he said flippantly when God says, "Where's your brother?" He says, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And people have been lying ever since. People have been lying ever since. Cain is saying, whatever we say when we give up self-control, he's saying the same thing. By our actions, by our attitudes, we're saying to God, "What gives you the right to question me? Who do you think you are? I'm in charge of my life, not you." And in our rebellious moments, we become very, very ugly people. Very ugly. It's amazing at the things people will say to people when they get mad. Oh, cold, cold, mean things, cruel things. Hit you where it hurts. Especially somebody that knows where you're weak and knows what hurts. And they will attack you on those spots when they get angry enough at you. But when we start speaking to God out of anger and disrespect, oh, that is an amazing thing. That's hard to believe that people would do that. But when we become rebellious, we become very ugly people. And the fourth reason that we would lose self-control is because our defenses are weakened. Proverbs 25:28, "Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls." We said that already. Like a city whose walls are broken down is a man who lacks self-control, according to the NIV. In the ancient cities, there were walls that surrounded those cities, and they were the protection that the people that dwelt there had against their enemies. Enemies would come up against those walls, and they couldn't get in, and it gave them time to prepare defenses, to repel attackers, to protect themselves. And people were less inclined to attack. Why do you think the Great Wall in China was built? To keep out invaders. So walls around the cities were for protection. And when those walls were broken down, the city could no longer defend itself. Our self-control is a wall that protects us from ourselves. Who is my own worst enemy? Who is my worst enemy? Me! And it's the same thing for you. It's not me, by the way. You are your own worst enemy. You're the one who causes yourself more harm than anybody on the planet. You're the one who decides to hurt yourself worse than anybody else on the planet ever could. You are the one who decides if you're going to serve God or if you're going to rebel against God. You're the one who makes that choice. You decide that. We need self-control to protect ourselves from ourselves. So, understand, how do we overcome this? How do we develop self-control? How do we do this? Well, first, the definition of self-control is simply the ability to break a chocolate bar into four pieces and eat only one. That's the definition of self-control. All right? Now, you girls, I know how tough that is. I'll tell you what, watching these three girls grow up, chocolate was king. Still is in some cases. And every now and then, they need some chocolate. And the ability to take a piece of chocolate, break it in four pieces, and eat only one, that is the definition of self-control. At least, that's the one I found. The dictionary tells us that self-control is the control of one's own emotions, desires, and actions. Now, this doesn't mean you don't feel your emotions, but you control them instead of letting them control you. The difference between an adult and a child, other than physical maturity, is self-control. Self-control. Potty training, it's all about self-control. And the ability to shut your mouth instead of opening and saying something when you shouldn't is self-control. It has been said it's better to let men think you're a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. And that is indeed a wise, wise saying. Self-control is what keeps us from sticking our foot in our mouth. Self-control is what will help us to avoid those personal disasters that come from giving in to our impulses. Biblically, self-control simply means self under control. Galatians 5:23 says, self-control is one of the aspects of the fruit of the Spirit. Romans 8:9 says that we as Christians are not in the flesh but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. It is a matter of surrendering our thoughts, our actions, and our reactions to the control of God. Or namely, letting God's Word determine what my reaction or response will be. Now, this control is not God doing it. It is called self-control for a reason, brothers and sisters. You're the one that's got to do it. I was reading in my research for this sermon. I couldn't believe all the people that were saying, oh, self-control is something you have to get from God. That you can't control yourself till God blesses you with self-control. Friend, why would they call it self-control? Why do they call it self-control if it's not you that has to do it? Can somebody explain that to me? It's self-control. So, how do we do it? How do we do it? Let me give you four practical ways real quick in the next 7 minutes. Let's time it. Number one, admit you have a problem. That's tough. I tend to lose self-control, don't you? I mean, I tend to do it. I've got to take responsibility for my lack of self-control. James chapter 1, verse 14, each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lusts or his own desires and enticed. I want you to notice the source of the temptation. Does not say the devil made me do it. It does not say it came from the way my parents raised me. It does not say because of my past experience or abuse or because of a painful experience in my past, I can't control my behavior today. It doesn't say that. It says that I am tempted when I'm drawn away by my own desires and are enticed by those desires. I do it to myself. The source of my lack of self-control is me. We do bad things because we like to do them, brethren. And we need to admit that right up front before we can go any further. So, where are you lacking self-control in your life? Huh? Do you have a problem with alcohol, time management, drugs, temper, gossip? Maybe the way you spend your money. Maybe it's lust. Maybe it's greed. Maybe it's laziness. Where do you lack self-control? Whatever you're struggling with, face it. And then begin to bring it to God. And pray about it. Pray about it. And work on it. And ask God to give you the strength. But keep working on it. And working on it. And working on it. Now God knows about it already. You're not bringing Him any new information. But by admitting your problem and bringing it to Him, you're starting down the right path. And that's pointing yourself in the direction of developing self-control. So, You know, let me just say this. Several have mentioned recently about church attendance. Let me tell you why church attendance drops on Sunday night and Wednesday night. Now, this is other than those that have work shifts. This is other than those who are physically unable to return. This is other than those who, because of health or physical weakness or whatever, that are not able to return. But for those who are physically able and their schedules are not confined by work or anything like this, here's the reason why people do not come back on Sunday night and Wednesday night. There's only one reason. I said there's only one reason. Only one. Here it is. They don't plan to come back. They don't plan to come back. If you plan to do something, you're more likely to do it. If you certainly do not plan to do it, you're less likely to do it. And if you plan not to do something, you're certainly more likely not to do it. But if you don't plan not to do something, there's a possibility you may do it. Now that sounds a little complicated, but understand this. Sunday morning is the main worship service of the week. This is God's command, that we assemble together for worship. Now, if the main assembly was Sunday night, then that's when you got to be here. But if this, in this case, the main assembly is on Sunday morning. And so that's when you're expected by God to be present. Now, our elders have taken a wise and honest stance on this subject. And they've done it based on Scripture. And they've made it clear that Sunday night, Wednesday night services are not mandatory. They're not mandatory. You can't say, oh, if you're not here on Sunday night, Wednesday night, you're going to hell. Can't say that. Elders won't say that. They don't say it. I respect them for this. But understand this. Elders watch for our souls. Elders watch for our souls. They are looking out for us. They want to be able to give a good account for us. They know where we need to grow spiritually. They know where we need to mature. They know where we're weak. They don't know every detail about our individual lives, but they know human nature. That's one of the things that makes them qualified to serve as elders, is they know human nature, and they know the tendencies that people have. And so the elders are trying to plead with us and encourage us, and they make the Sunday night and Wednesday night services, Sunday school on Sunday morning, they make these times available for us to assemble, to study, to learn, to grow, to worship, to enjoy fellowship. They make these available for us. But the reason people don't come back is they just don't plan to come back. The solution is plan to attend. Plan to be here. Just go ahead and plan on it. Put that in your schedule. Mark it on your date book. You've got a weekly appointment. Sunday morning, 9:30. Worship, 10:30. Sunday night, 5 o'clock. Wednesday night, 7 o'clock. Just put it in your schedule book. This is your plan. I'm going to be here. Now, again, I already stressed, if you're not able, you know, you've got a work schedule, you are physically not able to get out in the evenings, okay, fine. That's one thing. But for the rest of us, we need to just go ahead and put it in the book and plan to attend. If it's your plan and it's your practice to attend every service, that is what you will do. And it will be the exception when you're not here rather than the rule. So that's the first point, is that you have to admit that you've got a problem when it comes to self-control. Second, forget your past. Forget about it. You've got to put the past behind you. Your past failures, your past victories. Put it all behind you. That's what Paul says in Philippians 3, 13, 14. Forgetting what's behind, pressing on toward the mark. Now, he's not resting on his good past, and he's not wallowing in his past failures. He's moving on. And that's what we have to do. We have to just get on with it. We have to just get on with it. The third thing is rule over your emotions and impulses. Don't let them rule you. The difference between an adult and a child is ruled by their emotions and impulses. An adult rules over theirs. An adult rules over their own. You still feel what you feel. The heart wants what it wants. Understood. And there's no emotion that is sinful. All emotions are normal. But you have to rule over those emotions or you will sin by giving in to impulses that are not right. So, impulses and emotions cause us to throw caution to the wind, let our hair down, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. We need to challenge our emotions and live up to what God commands. Live beyond what we feel. Live in obedience to the will of God. Titus 2:12, for the grace of God teaches us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. That's what the bulletin article was about this week. We don't give in. We can resist. We can say no. Finally this morning, avoid temptation. Avoid temptation. If I have a weakness for ice cream, wouldn't it be foolish for me to keep ice cream in my house? If I'm trying to lose weight, wouldn't that be foolish? I sure want some ice cream, but I don't have any in my house. If you're tempted by pornography, you need to be very careful what you do on the internet or what you watch on TV. If that is something you're tempted by, you best be very, very careful. If you struggle with a quick temper, focus on its effect upon others. That will help you control it. You've got a quick temper? What is it doing to your loved ones? What's it doing to the people you meet when you blow up and you have a temper? An explosion never creates, it always destroys. A quick temper is one of the devil's favorite tools. We need to avoid those areas where we're tempted in life. And you certainly can't avoid every temptation. But you need to identify the areas where you're the weakest and build a barrier, build a protection for yourself. Robert Orrin was right when he said, most people want to be delivered from temptation, but would like to keep in touch. Think about that. The late Portia Nelson wrote these amazing thoughts. I want you to listen carefully as we conclude this morning. Portia Nelson, she was one of the nuns in The Sound of Music, all right? Passed away a couple of years ago. But listen to what she said. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. And it takes me forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. And it still takes me a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It is a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Finally, I walk down another street. The end. That is the progress of developing self-control. That's the progress, that's the process right there summed up in that little poem. Now folks, we have to admit we have a problem. We have to bring it to God and forget our past. We have to make up our mind to rule over our impulses and our emotions. Just rule over them. And we have to try to avoid the temptation that put us there in the first place. That's what we have to do to regain or to develop self-control. As you examine your life and your heart, your relationship with God this morning, if there is anything standing between you and God today, you need to do something about it. And the way you can avoid getting back in that mess is by self-control. You can choose wisely. Choose to trust in the Lord and do what He says. Choose not to demand your own way, but to surrender and submit to God. That's what self-control is all about. So as you look at your life and your relationship with God today, if there's anything that you need to change, Change it. Change it now. Change it today. If you need to come, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.